I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome back to Radio Times. Years ago, when I was much younger, I tried practicing transcendental meditation. It was extraordinarily difficult trying to get my mind to quiet down, to stay in the present, and focus on my mantra. I eventually gave it up. Today, mindfulness meditation is popular, even trendy. Practicing mindfulness is purported to have health benefits for our mind and our body, an antidote to our hurried and stressful lives. It's being used in schools, in businesses, in prisons, hospitals, cancer centers, by athletes, Marines, and others. We wanted to know more about mindfulness meditation, what it is, how to do it, and what it can do for us. And we have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Linda Carlson is the Enbridge Research Chair in Psychosocial Oncology and Professor in Psychosocial Oncology in the Department of Oncology at Cummings School of Medicine at the University of Calgary. She's also the Director of Research and works as a clinical psychologist in the Department of Psychosocial Resources at the Tom Baker Cancer Center. And Linda Carlson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And also joining us by telephone is Amishi Jha, Associate Professor of Psychology and the Director of Contemplative Neuroscience Mindfulness Research and Practice Initiative at the University of Miami. And Amishi Jha, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, Marie.
Nice to have you both with us. And Amishi, let me begin with you. What's mindfulness meditation? Let's start really basic.
Okay, sounds great. So mindfulness, actually, we could think about as a mental mode or a way of making the mind that has to do with paying attention in the here and the now, so in the present moment, without a story about it or emotional reactivity around what's happening.
And a lot of the focus is on breathing, and I guess breathing is what, in many ways, can keep us in the here and now.
That's right. So, you know, you mentioned that you had some experience with transcendental meditation, and there's a mantra or a phrase that you would repeat. Mm-hmm. The breath ends up being a good anchor because it's always available to us. It's quite portable, and it helps us focus on the present moment as it changes in the present moment.
And Amishi, do you practice mindfulness meditation yourself?
I do.
And what got you doing that?
Actually, my time at Penn. So before I was a professor at the University of Miami, I had the wonderful opportunity to spend almost 8 or 9 years at the University of Pennsylvania as an assistant professor. And most of my work was in the topic of attention and how the brain pays attention. But after a while, I started getting very curious about how we might strengthen this brain system and if there were any training tools that we could apply. That's where mindfulness meditation came in. And we started looking at how the brain and behavior change when people practice it. In fact, most of my work there was with a good friend, Michael Baim, who's the director of Penn's program for mindfulness. Yeah. So that got me practicing to help my own kind of management and awareness of my own life. And we brought it to the laboratory to track it in others.
And are you more attentive as a result of your mindfulness meditation, Amishi?
You'd have to ask my family.
Well, no, but you must know, right?
I mean, absolutely. In fact, that's what got it to be compelling to me to even make it worthy of bringing to the laboratory, is that I felt that my life was passing me by, that the stress, overwhelm, overwork, and frenzied pace of, I guess, what all of us experience really didn't feel satisfying to me anymore. And I wanted a way to really be able to enjoy and live the moments of my own life. So after reading about it and practicing myself and sitting in with some of Michael Baim's courses, it was clear to me that I was actually more able to, you know, for example, listen to my daughter tell me about her day, or watch my son's soccer match, or have an actual conversation with my spouse without feeling like I was lost in my own mind wandering. So that made it very obvious to me that this is something worth tracking, and that my own attention was something that was being impacted by this practice.
Well, Linda, let me get you in on the conversation. How did you get interested in mindfulness meditation?
Sure. So my story is quite a bit different, but can I step back a moment and just add to the definition
Absolutely.
Of mindfulness first? Yeah, so Amishi focused on the present moment awareness element of it, and so that's keeping your mind centered in the present rather than where it often goes, which is ruminating on the past or worrying about the future. So that's one element, but the second part that's also extremely important, and she touched upon that, was the non-judgmental part. So it's the attitude that we approach the awareness or the attention with. And that's really important, especially when you are starting out with a mindfulness practice. So we talk about being kind and being open and especially being accepting of what you find when you go inside and begin to pay attention. Because sometimes, you know, it's not all, you know, roses and teacups, right? It can be really difficult things that people are struggling with. So a sense of acceptance and willingness to witness your own suffering and be compassionate is really important in the practice as well.
Well, it sounds like you do practice this, Linda, based on your definition there.
Yeah, and so I came at it. I'm a clinical health psychologist, so I actually began sitting in mindfulness practice when I was a graduate student at McGill University in the early 1990s. And I was so fortunate to actually have a classmate who had intensive training in mindfulness meditation and had spent 7 years in Asia as a Buddhist monk, in fact, and was now training to be a clinical psychologist. So he started a practice group, and that really helped me get through the stress of graduate school. And then when I was finishing up my training, I got into the area of working with people with physical health conditions, and specifically in my case with cancer, and really found that those practices were so applicable for the suffering and all the existential questioning, as well as just the physical symptomatology that people going through cancer treatment were dealing with.
The idea that it can help deal with the pain, I guess, what, the upset of going through some kind of cancer treatment?
Yeah, both the emotional and the physical suffering are really amenable to this kind of approach. You know, and it is broadly applicable to lots of different situations, but specifically, imagine, I almost everybody's been touched by some kind of chronic disease, if not cancer, heart disease, or diabetes, or MS, and that moment of the diagnosis, hearing those words, you know, I'm sorry to tell you, but you have cancer.
Mm.
Well, that just spins people into a real turmoil. And I'm sure many of your guests have had that experience, and it leaves you kind of floundering, and all of a sudden your plans are maybe not going to pan out the way you thought. And there's a lot of uncertainty, and there's this loss of control. And, you know, we find it really difficult to deal with not feeling like we have control over the course of our lives. So the mindfulness approach, it's more of a what we would call an emotion-focused coping rather than problem-focused coping. So you're actually taking time to sit down quietly and be with those difficult emotions, and it's an opportunity to process them in a very simple way.
Well, picking up on what you both said, and Amishi, let me go back to you. I mean, do you have to meditate in order to be mindful, to be able to kind of pay attention to one's family, one's coworkers, to be aware about one's body and one's emotional reactions to situations? Do you have to be able to meditate in order to experience that?
I think that's a great question, and I would say that a lot of ways of thinking about you know, mindfulness training, mindfulness meditation is akin to the way we think about physical fitness. So you might ask the same question, do you actually need to exercise to be physically fit? And at some level, you'd say, well, yeah, it helps. And I think the same thing is true here. The work in my own lab has actually looked at how offering mindfulness training programs, mindfulness meditation, can help protect against the kind of degradation that happens in our own emotional state and our own attentional ability under high stress. So Linda mentioned, you know, people that have just received a diagnosis of a chronic or, life-threatening illness. I work with populations for whom high stress and high demand are part of their profession. So soldiers, firefighters, football players, et cetera, for whom they have intensive periods of training and demand that can really be taxing of these present moment, awareness and ability to be aware of what's going on around you in a non-reactive way. So learning these practices and exercising them is very similar to strengthening any kind of physical muscles that we might want to strengthen before we, you know, essentially go out and face the challenges that are ahead.
Linda, let me go back to you. And you emphasized the non-judgmental part of a mindfulness meditation. And I'll just going back to my feeble attempts at transcendental meditation. I found it so boring. I mean, how do you deal with something like that?
That's interesting, that concept of it's boring. Because when you begin to actually authentically open up to what's happening in your present moment experience, it's anything but boring. In fact, it can be overwhelming. There's so much going on if we really open our senses. There's, you know, what's happening in the physical realm with sensation in your body. There's all sorts of emotions that may be arising. There's sounds in the environment. So you can go through all your senses. And then most difficult to distance from and observe without getting wrapped up in it is the thoughts themselves that are constantly being produced by your mind. And so that actually brings me to another element of what's really helpful with the mindfulness practice is being able to separate or distance yourself a little bit from what's going on in your mind, the thoughts that are being produced, and realize that they're not necessarily true. You know, they're not necessarily who you are. It's not actually the case that what your mind is telling you is the way it is in the world. So being able to see things, to relate to your thoughts in a different way. So you're not actually trying to change your thoughts necessarily, but beginning to see them as not that important. So I don't know if that really addresses the boring question. The other approach is like, yeah, maybe it is boring for you as you begin to sit, but that's okay.
Right.
Can you sit with the boringness? Can you be with your experience in a different way and not jump up and rush to your devices or the TV or make a phone call? So learning to be comfortable with stillness and quietude.
Amishi, let me pick up on something you said earlier about some of the people that you've worked with, people in the military, athletes. How does mindfulness help, let's say, someone, I don't know, returning from Iraq? Is there an application for mindfulness meditation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it ends up that most of the folks that are returning from Iraq are also, unless they get out of the military, going back into the deployment cycle. So most of the volunteers that we've had in our projects are multi-tour folks that have had a lot of experience in combat and then come back again to prepare and then go back. And we've worked with them in what we'd call the pre-deployment period. So this is after returning back, getting ready for the next mission, which really, the intention there is to best prepare them for what's ahead, you know, getting operational details in line, learning about what they need to do when they go. But that period itself can be very demanding on their time and their emotional state. So what we wanted to see is, could we offer mindfulness training in that pre-deployment interval and protect against, you know, essentially buffer them to the depletion that we expected they might experience in their emotional well-being and their attention. And what shocked us was that when we looked at, you know, these are Marines and soldiers, so both the Marines and the Army, when we looked at people that and we involved in our project but didn't offer training to, in an 8-week period, even before they're about to deploy, so this is really intended to prepare them for deployment, if we did nothing at all over that 8 weeks, their emotional well-being and their attention declined. So as they got closer to their deployment date, they actually got worse. But fortunately for the folks that got the mindfulness training program and that practiced it, they actually protected against that and benefited.
Well, we have to take a very short break. I do want to pick up on that. We are talking about mindfulness meditation in this hour of Radio Times. That's Amishi Jha. Also with us is Linda Carlson. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and in this hour of the show, we are talking about mindfulness meditation, talking with Amishi Jha. She's Associate Professor of Psychology, also the Director of Contemplative Neuroscience Mindfulness Research and Practice Initiative at the University of Miami. Also with us is Linda Carlson, Chair in Psychosocial Oncology and Professor in Psychosocial Oncology in the Department of Oncology at Cummings School of Medicine at the University of Calgary. Also works as a clinical psychologist at the Tom Baker Cancer Center. And if you want to join the conversation, I see a lot of people do, call us at 1-888-477-9499. Amishi, let me go back to you. You were talking about your work with Marines and soldiers ready to deploy into Iraq and finding those that did mindfulness meditation as a kind of preparation really had some benefits. Explain what those benefits were.
Right. So as I mentioned at the start of our conversation, you know, I study attention. So my window into what was changing was really around the potential protective effects on the brain's attention system. And as you can imagine, our attention is necessary for every single thing that we do, from focusing on the task at hand to making sure that our goals align with our behavior and our behavior aligns with our goals. And what we found was that when we didn't offer this, sort of the natural course of what happens to people under, I mentioned the soldiers and Marines, that under a high-stress interval of preparing for deployment, their attention declined. But we also find this with students, for example, or other groups that have a high-stress period of engagement. And so doing nothing at all depletes attention, but actually practicing mindfulness meditation protects against that, so that the people that were in the training group and actually did the exercises that were asked of them didn't decline. They, in fact, the more they did, the more they benefited. Some were even above where they started at the end of the 8-week interval.
Did that make them better soldiers and Marines?
Right. So that's the question, right? So the first, our part of our interest, and all of this work comes from the medical command of the military, is to see if having better access to your attention makes you more discerning versus distracted, so that your behavior is in line with what you're trying to achieve there, instead of being, sort of dysregulated or reactive, and how that affects psychological health. So in addition to finding these protective effects for attention, we found that their mood was better. They had less negative mood and more positive mood when they actually engaged in more practice. So that's the long-term question is, how does it affect their ability to protect against kind of what we know now is a very big problem that the military faces with regard to psychological health in our service members, as well as doing their job better so that they're not behaving in a way that they regret later on, for example.
And there's much that you said there, Amishi, that I want to pick up on. But Linda, let me get you in on the conversation, or back in on the conversation. And you've been doing some interesting research involving breast cancer survivors, even seeing some changes at the cellular level. Can you explain what you've been doing?
Sure. And in fact, we've been working for the last 15 to 20 years with cancer survivors of all different types and people during treatment. The specific study you're alluding to was just with breast cancer survivors, and we've been looking at a range of what we call biomarkers or markers of health in the body. So in that particular study, we had women who were randomly assigned to three different treatment groups, and one was training in mindfulness-based cancer recovery, we call it. So it's 8 weeks of intensive training and learning how to do mindfulness meditation. The other group was in what we call supportive expressive therapy, so that's like a traditional support group. And then there was a third group that was more of a control condition who just had a short one-day stress management seminar. And then we compared the groups before and after the interventions, and then we had also 6 and 12 months follow-up for all the women in that study. And one of the measures we look at is called salivary cortisol, so it's a measure of a stress hormone in the body. And the patterns of cortisol secretion relate to a person's chronic stress levels, and they're also predictive or can be predictive of disease progression in cancer survivors in some circumstances. Mm. So for that outcome, we showed that the people who did the mindfulness practice had the best response in terms of their cortisol secretion profile, so a healthier stress hormone secretion afterwards. So their stress hormones were reflective of what was happening with their self-report of feeling less stress symptoms across a variety of systems. So that was one marker, a biomarker. Then we also looked, you mentioned, getting into the cells. So we also took the blood samples and looked at what's called telomere length. So telomeres are the protective caps at the end of chromosomes, and they naturally shorten with aging, and shorter telomeres are also associated with increased risk for a number of diseases like diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. They've also been associated with a shorter survival time in cancer patients. So what we were able to show for the very first time was that over even a short period of just 3 months, it was actually both the people who got the support group and the mindfulness training had maintained their telomere lengths, but the women in the control condition who didn't have any of this support, their telomeres became shorter just over those 3 months of practice.
Does that tell you then it could help in recovering from cancer, or just sort of mitigating?
Well, it's very suggestive.
Very suggestive,
yeah. You know, and that's the next question. We don't really know what it means in terms of, susceptibility to having a recurrence of cancer or for disease progression or for susceptibility to other disease states. It's the first time this has actually been shown. It's a fairly new area of investigation. You know, other areas that we've shown that we do know are important are, for example, decreases in blood pressure. So, obviously, high blood pressure is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, and even more so in cancer survivors because the treatments they take, the chemotherapies, can be toxic to the heart. Yeah. And so we've shown that people who have elevated blood pressure over the 8 weeks of our program, it decreases to the same extent that you would see from a blood pressure medication even.
Well, based on what both of you have said, Amishi, it sounds like everybody should meditate. Yes? Is that the takeaway?
I'm heavy on that.
Well, yeah, no, go. Let me hear from you first, Amishi, and then to you, Linda.
I mean, I think that it's something that we want to be able to offer in a way that is accessible to people. In the same way, we might say everybody should exercise. But how do we deliver it in a way that's low cost, low tech, accessible, and portable for most kinds of populations? Again, the work that I've done in the high-stress kind of military context, you know, people that take the courses and don't do anything at all don't show any benefits. So just it's akin to going to the gym and having your trainer tell you about how great exercise is. If you don't actually do the exercises, you're not going to have a benefit. And that's the key is how do we motivate and interest people to give it a try at least to see if it has positive effects on their own lives.
Linda, you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a caveat to the prescription that everybody should be doing mindfulness. One thing is that it's not a proven treatment for, mental health conditions in general. So if someone's suffering, from a severe depression or an anxiety disorder even, or, a psychotic bipolar disorder or anything like that, they can't meditate their way out necessarily. So it's important that, people seek traditional counseling, seeing a psychiatrist or a psychologist for a proper diagnosis and whatnot. You have to bear that in mind. The other idea is that mindfulness, as you experience with your experimenting with TM, is that it can be very frustrating. And so it's important to have some kind of guidance or some kind of teacher. Doing it on one's own, even with guided meditations, you can get off track fairly easily. So I think having some point of contact, a live person, even if it's online, someone you can interact with and ask questions about to make sure that, you're on the right track. And then also looking at the intention behind the mindfulness practice is important. So examining why it is that you want to do it and making sure that you're tracking towards that, I guess, is also important in my mind.
We are talking about mindfulness meditation. That's Linda Carlson, also with us, Amishi Jha. And looks like we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. 1-888-477-9499. Linda, just picking up on what you just said about intention, and I did read an article in The New Yorker from earlier this year, the headline meaning saying the long marriage of mindfulness and money, about a course teaching hedge fund people in how to meditate, and the obvious result being, that makes them better hedge fund people. This is not to trash hedge fund people over anybody else, but the idea that somehow it will lead to a better bottom line, people making more money, success. I mean, this is a tradition that comes out of a, spiritual practice. Are you comfortable with that, Amishi Jha?
I mean, I think that this question comes up a lot with regard to our work in the military as well.
Sure.
And I think that, what consequences it has to people's behavior is sort of, we don't know yet. We don't know what the long-term effects are. It can be touted for whatever purpose, right? Being a better hedge fund person or a more successful warrior. And I think that we now need to see what the effects are. From my point of view, and it's very much aligned with what Linda said, I mean, I think that she's talking about, responsibly in the clinical context, it's not a panacea. It's not going to solve everything. And we have to be very careful and cautious about offering it to people through across a wide variety of vulnerabilities, for example. But in the context of healthy people, I think it should be considered that these raw workhorse systems of attention, working memory, emotion regulation, the things all of us need to function well and feel well, do get taxed through the day-to-day life that we lead. And, you know, we mentioned, you mentioned when you were talking about the money issue.
Yes.
One thing we know is that we need our working memory and our attention to hold our own ethical code. So it may be the case that we are well-intentioned with whatever our profession is, but we may lose that code because of our stress, because of the pressures we experience. And so part of that, I think, an interesting frontier in this area is how might mindfulness training help people preserve their own ethical code and make sure that their behavior is aligned with it in every decision they make.
Go ahead, Linda. Then we'll get to our callers.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that ethics and values play an important role in mindfulness training. And it does go back to the roots of the practice, which, depending on where you go geographically, but really the central focus in many traditions is the well-being of yourself and other beings, about being compassionate and about being kind. And so the ethical code and the values of the person practicing it are almost the foundation of the practice. And I do believe that, this is my personal belief, that people's intentions, or people at the core, are good intentions.
Hmm.
So as Amishi's saying, that really the mindfulness practice helps you uncover that. I think it helps you connect with that part of yourself that really is kind and compassionate, because I believe that that's the core of humanity, really. And so even if you are, as I think Amishi makes a good point, you're in a high-stress job that's pressuring you to make more and more money, the mindfulness practice, even if it's really focused on just the focused awareness and heightening your concentration, that through the practice, most people do get a sense of interconnection with humanity and, oh, I'm suffering, and if I'm like this, you know, everyone's like this, right? And how is it that I want to lead my life to be true to this part of myself? So we don't train people specifically in that necessarily, but I think it's a byproduct of the practice, is that people actually do become more aligned with their ethics and their values that are at the core of most of what we are.
Well, let me get some callers into the conversation. Looks like we have Nancy from Center City, Philadelphia. And Nancy, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hi there.
This is a great conversation. Like you, Marty, I did transcendental meditation for me. I think it was 1970, 71, something like that. And meditated off and on over the years. I have used my mantra throughout my life, particularly in stressful situations. But in 2009, I was diagnosed with lung cancer and used breathing and meditation to cope with my terror of that diagnosis. And then I discovered a technique called guided imagery. The book was by Dr. Andrew Weil and Martin Rossman, I think were their names. And the guided imagery walks you through a process of imagining that when you're getting chemotherapy, for example, the drugs are working perfectly, killing the cancer cells, but not damaging other cells. And then you imagine yourself healthy and happy and vital, you know, a month from now, 10 months from now, 5 years and so forth. And that was a tremendous help for me. And
I'm really glad.
Whenever a friend is diagnosed with cancer, I try to send them that book, because it was just so helpful for me. And it's, I think it's kind of like a stepsister to mindfulness meditation.
Well, you know what? Let's find out. Nancy and I do appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Linda, I'm going to toss that back to you, because you have worked with cancer patients.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Good for you, Nancy. To have been through that experience of lung cancer so long ago and to be doing well, congratulations. That's a really difficult journey. Yeah, I believe, the guided imagery, it is really a stepsister to the mindfulness meditation, because a lot of the processes would be common in terms of instilling a relaxation response in the body, and that's the opposite of the stress response. So deep breathing and sitting quietly and focusing on a point of concentration. You know, it could be the breath or it could be some of this imagery. It serves to bring down the stress levels in the body. So it's the opposite of that fight or flight. So you have your heart rate slows down, your breathing slows down. A whole bunch of things happen with your immune system and your stress hormones that induce relaxation. And that in and of itself can be helpful for the body in coping with, you know, all the different assaults of disease and treatment. Where it differs from the mindfulness practice, maybe in that it's more goal-directed. So mindfulness, really, the goal in general is just to be in the moment with whatever arises. And the guided imagery is a little bit more specific, specifically the way Nancy's describing it, where you're imagining, you know, in the chemotherapy situation, what's happening with the cells and it being successful. And that's harnessing, really, the power of expectancy in the mind, which I think is very strong, too. So I think it's a little bit different, but definitely has a lot of similarities as well. And many people find that to be a very effective approach.
Amishi, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with everything that Linda is saying. You know, we've actually done a project in which we put head-to-head mindfulness training and a visualization and relaxation training program. This was in elite college athletes. Because we wanted to see, you know, visualization and imagery, not only is it helpful in the context of cancer, as Nancy was saying, but it can be, it's a very traditional and effective sports psychology approach to performance success. And what we found is that both helped with mood. But that it ended up that as people got more and more depleted over a high stress preseason preparation period, it's harder to maintain one's attention, for example, and distractibility over that over the course of that stress, and only the mindfulness actually was able to preserve attention. So I think that there are complementary benefits, but attention does seem to be somehow tied to the exercises of mindfulness meditation.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And yes, we are talking about mindfulness meditation with Amishi Jha, Associate Professor of Psychology, also the Director of Contemplative Neuroscience Mindfulness Research and Practice Initiative, a bit of a mouthful, at the University of Miami, used to be here at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us is Linda Carlson, Chair in Psychosocial Oncology in the Department of Oncology at Cummings School of Medicine at the University of Calgary, also Director of Research, and works as a clinical psychologist in the Department of Psychosocial Resources at the Tom Baker Cancer Center. You can join the conversation at phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Amishi Jha and Linda Carlson about mindfulness meditation. We have a lot of people that want to join the conversation. A quick question to each of you. To you, Amishi, how do you feel about things like daydreaming or just the sort of mindless? It's not even meditation. It's just our mind takes a kind of vacation on us.
Right. I think actually it's a really interesting distinction between daydreaming and what we'd call mind wandering, because we might put them in the same category.
Right.
Daydreaming is something we would decide to do intentionally, a walk in the park, where we willfully allow our mind to go in its free-flowing conscious experience. Mind wandering, on the other hand, is when our attention is not aligned with what we're actually doing. So our mind is hijacked by internal preoccupations, memories, sensations, thoughts, not tied to the task at hand. And whereas daydreaming can be quite generative and helpful for creativity and positive visioning, etc., mind wandering can be quite problematic for our ability to perform the task at hand. In fact, one recent study by a colleague at UCSF ties back to Linda's point earlier around telomeres. She found, this is Alyssa Eppel, she found that when she asked high-stress moms of children with special needs about the amount of mind wandering they did, that, in fact, those with higher daily mind wandering, meaning, you know, you walk into a room, you don't remember why,
right,
or you get somewhere in the car and you have no idea what, or you're reading the same piece of paper over and over again without really knowing what's going on. People that have high mind wandering in their day-to-day life tend to have shorter telomeres than those that don't have high mind wandering. So that actually ends up being a target for what we want to try to curb with mindfulness training.
Well, and would you suggest...
Yeah, go ahead,
Linda. No, go ahead.
Oh. sorry, I was just going to add to that data on mind wandering. The other thing studies have looked at is, you know, sampling people's experience throughout the day and finding that mood is directly correlated to the degree of mind wandering. So if your mind is wandering in a neutral thoughts or negative thoughts, your mood is very negative. If your mind wandering in positive areas, that's more like daydreaming. Or if you're more mindful, you're actually in the moment, then your mood tends to be much more positive.
Let me get, looks like Drew from Phoenixville to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Drew, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing, Marty?
Good, how are you? Go ahead.
Doing well. Okay, I had an accident 2 years ago, actually, this fall. And so I was in ICU for 10 days.
Wow.
I had a broken rib, had surgery. They didn't have me under the anesthesia enough. I remembered everything they did. So it was like 3.5 hours of torture, basically. And so I developed PTSD, became suicidal, lost my business. And the only thing that really helped me through this whole thing was the medication. I mean,
wow.
I had to go to a psychiatrist, the therapist. I had a very good therapist that really helped me through this. But the meditation and the mindfulness really was what kind of brought me out of all this. And I'm still in it, but that's what really helps.
Well, I'm really glad, Drew, that it helped. And obviously, having gone through a pretty difficult situation, Linda, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
Yeah, Drew, I'm wondering, was it pain that was difficult for you, or was it more the flashbacks as part of the PTSD? Like, what exactly did the mindfulness help you to address?
Drew?
It was mostly going with forgiveness and trying to say, because actually, I was tortured by these doctors and nurses. You know, in my mind, I felt that way. So I felt everything they did for 3.5 hours, and it was just incredible. I woke up crying and apologizing to them. So just meditating.
Anger, yeah.
And just, it was a lot of anger, and then just so,
resentment.
And then losing everything. I mean, I almost lost my family, everything.
Wow.
But just being able
so there was a lot of blame. You were,
It sounds like, Drew, you said you had to, I guess, forgive what, them and yourself?
Yes. And plus, being in the ICU for 10 days, you're like helpless and you can't do anything for yourself. And you're just totally like, there's nothing you can do. And that feeling is horrible.
Well, Drew, I appreciate the call.
Yeah, that loss of control.
Go ahead, Linda.
Sure. Yeah. That loss of control can be terrifying for people, you know, that kind of experience. And all those emotional experiences that Drew is talking about, you know, there are ways that mindfulness directly addresses both, you know, forgiving yourself and others and dealing with loss of control and pain. So it's really interesting to hear that story.
Go ahead, Amishi. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I'm so happy to hear that it was beneficial to him. And forgiveness is a big thread of a topic that comes up. In fact, a lot of what happened with our work with the active duty military is that the soldiers and Marines came to us and said, look, I'm about to be deployed. Can you get this to my wife? Okay. And, you know, essentially, like, she's in that state of having no control, not knowing where I am. And it's kind of having to manage everything. So we now have developed a program. We're about to launch a project at Maxwell Air Force Base next week, actually, with Department of Defense funding, to offer mindfulness and compassion training to military spouses. And it's the same idea, is that this is a very difficult period of time, not only challenging for the person who's the service member, but the spouse who's holding down the fort.
Holding down the fort, and there are certain stresses, very unique stresses that come with that. I'm wondering, too, Amishi, and then we'll get back to our callers, if people just, for whatever reason, they just can't see themselves doing mindfulness meditation, but how about just plain old breathing, you know, and just paying attention to our breath and being more conscious about the way that we breathe, for instance?
So, let me make a statement about the breathing thing, because I think I want to be absolutely clear, and Linda can add more to this. When we talk about breath and mindfulness training, we are not talking about breath manipulation. This is not yogic breathing. This is actually using the breath as an anchor to look at the ongoing activity in our body and mind as they're unfolding in real time without a story about it. So essentially, that is the instruction for a mindfulness of breathing exercise. It's pay attention to the sensations of breathing. Be very specific about the sensation that you pick. For example, the coolness of air moving in and out of your nostrils or your belly moving in and out. So you're selecting very carefully a sensation. You're maintaining your attention there. And then when the mind wanders away, you're gently returning it. So, you know, that sensation could be the breath. It could be a phrase. It could be a visual image. It could be whatever you choose. But it's bringing this quality of non-judgmental, non-reactive attention to the unfolding that's happening.
In a sense, sort of, Linda, observing things almost outside of yourself, non-judgmentally?
Yeah, you know,
I wouldn't say just outside. Inside yourself, too.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. Yeah, no, go ahead, Linda.
Sure. I just wanted to address the question of sort of using breath awareness exercises. Is we actually teach people how to use things we call mini breathing or mini meditations. And so, I mean, she's right that with mindfulness practice, we just pay attention to what's there. But say, for example, one mini might be to count 10 breaths. And so just in and out, that's one. So you're stopping whatever you're doing. You're bringing your attention into the body. You're feeling sensations in the body. You're noticing the rising and falling of the breath. And one interesting thing that tends to happen when we pay attention to our breath is that it does naturally slow down a little bit and tends to settle the body. So one kind of exercise anyone can do anytime, anywhere, really. You don't have to close your eyes. You can be in traffic. You know, you can be in line at the grocery store. You can be waiting for a test at the doctor's office, but just take 10 breaths and pay attention to what's happening in your experience. And a lot of people find that that is just kind of a timeout, and it separates you from, you know, the stress of whatever's going on in the moment.
Let me get Heather from, looks like Percocet, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Heather. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Marty, for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to comment on, you know, getting started with meditation. You know, I heard Marty say it was boring. And, you know, honestly, it is really difficult for some people to start this practice. And I just wanted to share something that really helped me. I would set like a little egg kitchen timer for like 10 minutes at a time and just kept up with it, focused on the breath, sat with my feet, you know, firmly grounded on the floor and, you know, upright chair and, you know, breathed in through the nose, out through the mouth, and just kind of really paid attention to the breath. But, you know, over the years, I've worked up to 45 minutes a day. So it really helped. But it is a little tricky if you're the kind of person that likes to run, and, you know, your mind's always going. I think it's particularly a little more difficult for those type of people.
Heather, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Amisha, anything you want to add to what she said?
I would say, unfortunately, the racing mind is the human condition, and that we are all, you know, I'm so happy to hear of, you know, her ability to increase from 10 to 45 minutes. What we're finding is actually that, you know, no matter in a research context, you can assign however many minutes. We assigned 30 minutes to the groups that we work with. And what we looked at was how much they actually practiced. We asked them to be honest with us. And that the more they practiced, the more they benefited in terms of their attention and mood. The magic number for one of our studies was something like 12 minutes a day. So it's not an inordinate amount of time. And I think that number varies depending on the instruction and, you know, many different things, the individuals that we're dealing with, the high stress that they may experience. But I think that getting started and making a commitment to some period of time is a good way to go. And can be beneficial with not too much time commitment.
We have an email from Drew who's saying, he's saying, why is Buddhism not mentioned when discussing mindfulness? Is it that it's more palatable to Americans as a new scientific discovery? Lynn, can you weigh in on that at all?
Yeah, I mean, the background to a lot of the practices and the programs that are happening here in North America is through something called mindfulness-based stress reduction that was developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn in the late 1970s. And he specifically took some of the ideas and concepts that indeed do come from a Buddhist framework, but sort of combined them in a package that was more secular and, yes, more palatable to people from a wide range of different religious backgrounds, because these trainings, these ideas are actually common to many different contemplative and religious frameworks. So the idea was not to alienate anyone or to scare anyone away from these, you know, largely attentional practices that can be very universally applied. So that's generally been the approach from all the programs that are based on mindfulness-based stress reduction, is to, you know, provide them in a very sort of non-denominational way so that people from across the spectrum can access the wisdom of these practices.
Let me get Russ from Phoenixville to join us. Russ, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm specifically calling because I have a loved one who is now experiencing she had an addiction to opiates. and it's been recommended she started doing mindfulness. And I was just wondering the effectiveness with mindfulness in treating addictions.
Let me see if Amisha Jacques can respond to that. Amisha, do you have anything you can say? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Linda can also speak to this. But one of the programs that's currently being heavily researched and offered is something called mindfulness-based relapse prevention, which is very much around addictions and craving, and the effectiveness for a variety of different conditions, you know, different addictive disorders has been found to be beneficial. And it's very similar to this 8-week program that Linda mentioned, mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's tied to having a group context in which people meet regularly with a very seasoned facilitator. They get homework exercises. There's discussion. But the anchoring concepts have to do with this shared experience of suffering from addiction.
Linda?
Yeah, there's another program, too, called MORE. It's Mindfulness-Oriented Recovery Enhancement. It's the same idea, and they've been doing research specifically on opioid withdrawal and people who have chronic pain. And, you know, the adaptation that's specific to people with addictions adds in stuff around cravings and how to deal with urges and how to use the mindfulness practices to get you through those really difficult times, as well as having the group support there. So those programs are available, and I would encourage people to seek them out. And even if that's not available in your region, the traditional mindfulness-based stress reduction can be helpful for getting over some of those difficult times.
There is some mindfulness meditation backlash. I'm actually looking at a piece Adam Grant, who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, had in the New York Times asking, the title was, "Can We End the Meditation Madness?" His complaint, or I guess his critique, Amisha Jacques, was that it's being applied across the board. It's that the people are thinking, if I meditate, then X, Y, and Z is going to happen to me.
Right, and I definitely read that piece with interest.
I figured.
Because Linda and I were both actually at a meeting I hosted here in Miami where we brought together 30-plus of the top kind of people interested in the clinical and neuroscience applications of mindfulness. And I would say we're aligned with the spirit of self-critique around keeping standards very high and having depth of understanding regarding for whom, for how long, and in what way these practices should be offered. But I would say that, you know, that kind of a reaction, Adam's reaction, is very much what happens when there's something new that's taking shape within our culture. You know, he cites some of the downsides,
right,
that there's potential contraindications to mindfulness. And I would say the same thing is true if somebody looked at the term exercise up, that, you know, there's downsides to that. There's downsides to psychopharmacologic treatments. And what we need to do is get better at honing in our understanding of how these practices can have an impact.
Linda, about 30, 40 seconds before I have to say goodbye. Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was going to say there may be people who have tried it and are very enthusiastic about it and, you know, make extraordinary claims, but the researchers are usually the ones who are careful to constrain, you know, what its applications are based on our knowledge of the research and the data.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. Linda Carlson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Very happy to have been here.
And she's chair of psychosocial oncology in the Department of Oncology at Cummings School of Medicine, and that's at the University of Calgary. Amisha Jacques, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
This was a lot of fun, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Associate professor of psychology. She's also director of contemplative neuroscience, mindfulness research and practice initiative at the University of Miami. Lots of interest in this topic. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Excuse me. And you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Dinah Allen, our intern this fall for Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.